You're listening to Campus Review Radio.
Welcome to HeadX, hosted by Martin Betts. This podcast explores the changing landscape of the higher education sector. Welcome to the Higher Education Experience.
Well, welcome back to the HeadX podcast, and we're delighted to join you for this special edition of the podcast at the start of the week to give last week's HeadX conference on changing higher education for good a full public airing with the first of four sessions from the day that explored the issue of sector's leaders' reactions to the recently released Universities Accord final report. And what, after a few weeks of reflections on the 47 recommendations that 408 pages had generated, the sector's leaders think about where we're heading and where the government's response starts to be made. We'll be having insights from the chair of UA, Professor David Lloyd of University of South Australia, its Vice-Chancellor, together with a panel of other Vice-Chancellors and Deputy Vice-Chancellors from a variety of universities around the nation to reflect on what they think about where we're heading and what the major challenges and issues are in the deliberations that are ahead. So straight after this message from our sponsors, we'll hear about the start of a very special day for HeadX.
Short on resources to enhance your university's online learning objectives? OES's collaborative approach ensures program success while offering flexibility across disciplines. Our tailored solutions uphold academic rigour and your reputation. Choose OES for adaptable, high-quality online learning experiences.
This day, for me, is about bringing that to a head, about accelerating that in the context of what's going on in Australia, but what's going on everywhere in the world, which is more people want higher education, but not more people are willing to pay for it. People that are paying for it are finding their experiences challenging and that they're debt-inducing and really painful. And I think we have a responsibility to make sure that what we're doing in delivering that education is the best it can be, is affordable, is engaging, and is truly transforming to everyone in our society that has an opportunity to gain from it, not just to some of those people. And now invites our first, I don't know whether I should call them keynotes. Yes, I have called him a keynote, so I better stick to that title. He is Professor David Lloyd. He's the Vice-Chancellor of the University of South Australia. He's the Chair of Universities Australia. I really hope someone's going to click something and he's going to appear on the screen from Adelaide. And I invite David and say welcome to you, David. Great to have you here. What do you think of the university's accord as David Lloyd, as Universities of South Australia and as UA? What do you think of it and what happens next?
Thanks, Martin. Thanks for that welcome. I'm joining you this morning from, I'm online from Garnaland. I hope you can hear me. I have no idea if you can or not. But I pay my respects to elders both past and present, and apologies for my unexpected physical absence this morning. Someone pointed out to me that whenever I give a big speech, I end up crook. So I am crook here, and I'm here to talk about the Accord. It seems to me that is really much, very much all we've done for the last 12 months, as we've worked so closely with Mary O'Kane and our panel to help shape the report. And now that we have the report, funnily enough, we're still doing a lot of talking. Talking has been very important because it's led us to where we are now, where we have an extensive blueprint of reform ideas to work from. Now, as a sector, I think it's pretty safe to say that our voice has been heard. It's been considered in the development of the final report. And there's certainly way more in the 408 pages of the report to welcome than not to welcome, which I think is a pretty common view held right across the university landscape and by industry. But I have to be honest, for my part, I'm looking forward to doing less talking and to just getting on with the job at hand. And that is about working with government to try and bring Mary and the panel's vision for future higher education in Australia to life. It is a transformational vision. It's one that acknowledges our sector's role in supporting Australia's future through the education of skilled workers and through the R&D activities that we undertake that help Australia to navigate the many multi-generational challenges which lie before us. The recommendations that underpin Mary's vision 47 things that the government is currently considering, they all underscore the need for a high-functioning and high-performing university system. Now, that need is not lost on anyone in this room, but as with any big potential change, there are a lot of people who are saying, this all looks great on paper, but how are we ever going to bring that thing to life? And I certainly understand that, possibly a little bit more than most, given the activities which are going on close to home here in South Australia. But I can also point to what's happening in South Australia at the moment and hold that up as an example of how progressive change in higher education can become a reality. So I know I'm here in my capacity as the chair of Universities of Australia, but I'll just put on my UniSA hat for a minute. UniSA and the University of Adelaide are creating a new for-purpose university in South Australia that is designed to meet the needs of a modern community. And we're doing that with the support of both sides of state politics, with the support of the federal government and our industry partners who are helping to inform and guide our curriculum design and our research directions. So very much of what the Accord panel has advanced as being vital to the future for Australia, vital for Australia's economic performance, for our democratic cohesion, for environmental sustainability, is actually written large in the purpose and strategy that we've advanced for our new Adelaide University. There's access to education for non-traditional entrants, for underrepresented groups, embedding First Nations knowledges in curriculum, putting success of students at the heart of what happens in every institution, research in partnership with end users, flexible delivery of high-quality education, building a curriculum around modular, stackable and transferable qualifications. Now, when we were working to describe our vision of a new for-purpose Australian university for the future last year, it appears that we were mirroring the work of those people who were charged with describing a better for-purpose Australian university sector for the future in the Accord work. We're working to create a university that will be top-ranked for research, among the world's best institutions for equality and social impact, and a leader for graduate employability. And we reckon that those things can go together. And when they do, they foster and support a society that's inclusive, that's diverse and prosperous. And I believe that creating that type of society is central to how we must think about the Accord. It's not just about universities. It's about community. And with my UA hat firmly back on my head now, I want to stay with that theme of community just for a minute. In approaching this next phase of the Accord, we must think of ourselves and our sector as a community, and a community that exists only to serve Australia and Australians. That means that we have to work together as partners to help deliver Australia's prosperity, both today and into the future. And that's a non-trivial undertaking. It's one that the Accord final report aims to make a reality, but it's going to take 25 years of generational change in higher education to achieve that. When we're finished, the initiatives which are proposed will have helped produce a more competitive, a more successful, a more prosperous Australia. But the key question for me, Martin, is where do we begin? The government's intention is to establish an implementation advisory committee to prioritise the rollout of reforms. And that's a really welcome step, and it's one on which we wait for the details from Minister Clare with a great degree of eagerness. At UA, we've already called on the government to prioritise student support measures in the forthcoming federal budget. And this is in recognition of the Accord's emphasis on meeting the nation's current and future skill needs, and the need to arrest the decline in university enrolments, which we are witnessing at the moment. The new higher attainment targets, which are outlined in the final report, they confirm that Australia's future economy will be dependent on us producing more university graduates. And that's going to require the broadening of access, the increasing of enrolments among disadvantaged groups in society. And that's to be very strongly welcomed, because students are Australia's hope. We need our students to study hard, to get skills, to gain those skills, to conduct research and set us up for the future. Students, like every other Australian, they're all battling cost of living pressures. And we know that those cost of living pressures are chief among the factors which are turning people away from university right now. Mary and the panel have put the government a series of sensible measures which can support financial hardship and some financial success and sustainability for students. They are recommending improved income support payments, paid placements, fee-free preparatory courses, and modest and necessary changes to the HECS system. all of those recommendations are attainable in the near term. And those recommendations together could move the dial on participation and move the dial on addressing skill shortages. The imperative, of course, is to act now, to not just talk about these things, or we will risk the skill shortages plaguing our economy and the nation for decades. Cost of living has been at the centre of the Albanese government's first two federal budgets. And with these challenges persisting in the economy, we believe that targeted supports for students should be a key inclusion in any package that the Treasurer delivers to Australians in May. So I wrote in The Australian just last week, the complexity and the costs of measures that are contained in the final accord report, that will determine where they fall in the pecking order of implementation. But we have to remember that the accord's a blueprint for multi-generational reform across several decades and several changes of government. So it will require the support of successive governments for its success. And not everything can be funded immediately. And that's where the Implementation Advisory Committee is going to play an incredibly important role in staggering the realisation of those reforms as the government proceeds with them. I think there's one thing that's not in doubt, Martin, and that's from the public comments that our ministers made and from our own discussions with government, is the eventuality of an Australian Tertiary Education Commission. In many regards, most, if not all of the recommendations in the final report hang off the establishment of the ATEC. And if the government proceeds down that path, as we expect they will, then UA and the sector would like to be and deserve to be involved in that design process. The report's reforms will take many, many years to implement, but we can't afford to kick them down the road. The sooner we start, the better, and we have to get it right. And that includes getting any incarnation of an ATEC right. We have to think about things like, how big will it be? How far will the powers extend? Will it add value, or will it add another layer of red tape and bureaucracy? How will it differ from the functions already within the Department of Education? And I will point out, as a disclaimer, there's no link between my previous sentence and the second sentence that I just said there. Mm-hmm. Does it make sense for TEXA and the ARC to sit within an ATEC structure? Is it going to be a permanent body? Is it going to have a finite lifespan? I could go on. There's so many unknowns in this. And I know that so many of us in the sector and those there in the room have our own questions and views on the ATEC. The proposed establishment is perhaps the most urgent consultation that's needed of all of the items that are in the final report. And I urge the government to include the sector in any design process around such a significant structural reform. It would be absolutely remiss of me, of course, not to acknowledge another recommendation which is dominating conversations and generating media coverage, and that's the creation of a proposed Higher Education Future Fund, the so-called Recommendation 43, as we refer to it in shorthand. As a sector, we know we desperately need something that can replace the now-defunct Education Investment Fund. The closure of the EIF was a calamitous decision by a former federal government, and nearly 5 years on, we have no dedicated government funding for general teaching or research infrastructure projects. So any attempt which seeks to future-proof our sector should be viewed as a good thing and should be encouraged. But of course, there's huge debate about how a higher education future fund should be funded. And that's a conversation we will have as a sector with government, if and when the time comes. It is fair to question the merit of universities contributing portions of their own funds to a communal fund when our sector is now more financially vulnerable than at any other time in its history due to poor policy and pandemic consequences. The sector is also grappling with a wholly unanticipated and wholly avoidable financial hit, which is associated with the drop in international students stemming from the government's recent changes to visa processing systems. In the absence of dedicated government funding for infrastructure projects and declining government investment in research, our institutions have become more and more reliant on private sources of income to fund and support this ongoing work. But private funds and international student revenue can't be cemented as a compensatory mechanism for a lack of sovereign public investment in the cooperation of institutions. And that's why the HEF is a recommendation which is definitely worth exploring, and it's a debate that I'm looking forward to having and engaging with our sector and the government. My genuine excitement and anticipation and for the need to just get on with the job that's in front of us. Working together, working as partners in prosperity, and working with the government to make sure that Mary's vision, the panel's vision, for the third expansion of university education in Australia is brought to life.
I interviewed David for the HeadX podcast, I don't know how long ago, about 18 months or even more than that.
Longer.
And look, you were, I don't think you were the longest serving vice chancellor in Australia then, and there's probably some debate about whether you're the longest serving at one university or other people that might have been at multiple universities longer than you've been VC. I referred to you earlier and you didn't seem to object to me calling you the new kid in the block in my way of thinking about vice-chancellors when I interviewed you 2 or 3 years ago. You were the dynamic young vice-chancellor who was doing things like having uni-jams at UniSA with technology 15 years ago, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, to try and get thousands of people to engage over 36 hours, I said, with great new ideas using technology to set a new direction for a university. You also shared with me that after your graduation ceremonies, you invited all of your staff to hang on in a room with pizzas or sandwiches and redesign the organisation structure of your university by putting cards on piles of what made sense to the market. And you told me on that interview as well that you were resetting the University of South Australia to be a university of enterprise engaged with industry partners to differentiate itself. If you could do all of that in 36 hours with what you knew 10 years ago, why has it taken us 16 months to come up with 407 pages and 47 recommendations? Couldn't we have done this quicker?
We could have done it differently. I think, we probably would have got more ideas had we done an online jam session. But you have to question whether the quality and applicability of the ideas would have translated into something that's actionable. I think the beauty of the report that Mary's group have put together is that it hangs together as a coherent whole, and it's almost like an omnibus set of recommendations as a blueprint, which I don't know that a national jam session would have given that level of coherence, because they tended to be a spider web of innovation in terms of what we got from UniJam when we did it the 2 times. But Mary's taken a deep and deliberate approach to consultation and engagement, to iteration and to testing. And in many ways, I mean, when we ran the jams and when universities undertake strategic planning, it's something which is going to be coalesced to deal with a single entity, whereas this accord has got to be on things to all people. And while it was flagged that there would be winners and losers early on, probably between the interim report and the final report, I don't know if there are many losers on the page. I think Australia's going to win for this one.
Okay, so we couldn't have done a UA jam or an accord jam on this. I accept that. You talked a lot there about the implementation committee needing to look at the whole thing, and it is a coherent accord and recommendation, and that we need to get on with it. What are we going to do if we don't get on with it? What are we going to do if we don't get momentum here, if this set of recommendations don't get support, don't get funding? And maybe I can connect that with a question that comes back to your positioning as a university of enterprise at UniSA. John Dewar, that's the second time he gets a mention from the stage now, wrote something recently around him seeing that the immediate future is probably an opportunity for many Australian universities, I think it applies globally as well, to be more ambitious in thinking about differentiated strategies right now. That's perhaps what this report and this level of policy review generates for all of us, the chance to take chances, the chance to think of different ways forward as individual universities. So my question to you is, what are we going to do if this doesn't move forward in the way that we all hope it will? And what do you think will be the opportunity for individual universities to strike out on paths of radical differentiation, if that is the case?
I think on the second point first, the opportunity for radical differentiation is only realized when there's policy direction and guidelines which enable it. And I think policy is incredibly homogenous at the moment. It one size fits all, thou shalt educate in this way, we have bans that drive people in certain ways, there's less freedom to operate within the budgets which are allocated, and we're all being measured exactly the same way. The implementation is towards 39 public universities doing pretty much the same thing. The opportunity for radical differentiation is extremely limited by the policy settings. So I think in the Culture First Party, we don't see the implementation of what's in the accord. Well, in the first instance, we have an inequitable higher education contribution scheme setting for the bands. I think that the sector has talked about the way in which funding changes have impacted negatively both on students, particularly well, directly on students, but also in the way in which institutional funding works. We have seen drops in participation, and it's not about it's not directly linked to debt, but it's linked to the ability to engage in employment and not defer your income for many years. It's linked to things like B3 places in TAFE, which are more attractive to non-traditional entrants to higher education. At the same time, we're saying we want to drive participation in higher education from non-traditional entrants. So there are a number of, I would think, incongruous policy drivers in place right now, which just mitigate against that notion of differentiation. So we don't have implementation. I don't think we're going to get to the point where you can have a meaningful expression of the university compact, which works on a multi-annual basis, which is really at the core of what the accord is serving to try to do, to give certainty of funding and the permission and gearing for differentiation of the system. So to John's point in that piece that he wrote, you can certainly have all of the aspiration and intent to be a differentiated institution, but if you've got a homogenous set of policy levers in play, they're not just not going to let that happen.
Okay, and look, we're getting lots of questions coming in and votes on those questions, so I'm looking at them in terms of popularity there. There's one there from Greg Hange, the head of school of languages and culture at UQ, who you won't be able to see this, David, but he's drawing attention to what I think is a bit of an elephant in the room, that the overriding message in the accords for us in Australia is of a government that wants to see expansion in the sector at a time of low domestic enrolment and companies that appear to be expressing that they don't need university qualifications in quite the same way. How do we make sense of the apparent contradiction between a wish from government and of the sector itself to see growth in enrolments in universities and TAFE, and a market at the moment which doesn't seem to want to join in with that aspiration?
I counter the notion that the employers don't want university graduates. I think if you look at the professions, you can look across nursing, doctor, midwifery, engineers, there's a long, long list of university professions where we know we have huge skill gaps and massive gaps in the numbers of qualified individuals. And that we need to deliver those. I mean, I think the Productivity Commission has looked at this inside out to say that we need to have university-qualified individuals to drive our workforce and our competitiveness on a national basis. I do find it interesting that there's a postulation that industry doesn't want graduates when we can see that we've got near full employment and people are crying for skilled graduates left, right and centre. And it's not just technologies, as I said, it's in the services, it's in the professions. So we do not have enough in the pipeline to service the needs of the S-riding economy. There may well be some areas that are saying, well, we can do it at a university qualification. But all along, everybody in the university has been quite clear in saying that not everyone needs to go to university. Right? And I think, though, there are some professions, and the bulk of them, that drive the economic success in this nation, which will require and do require a university qualification.
Okay, and we've got time for perhaps at least one, maybe two more. So Heather Marsh, the Director of Student Equity, Safety and Wellbeing at, it's running out on my line, but I think it's Victoria University, apologies if I've got that wrong. She's drawing attention to the need to uplift the capability of the academy to respond to and to support an increase in support for students from equity backgrounds. So she's asking for thoughts. I guess she's challenging us to be sure we know how to do that and have it within ourselves to make that possible.
Yes, and it's a great question, and it links back to that point of differentiation and to this notion of homogenization. So there's no question in my mind that we, to broaden participation, means that non-traditional entrants need to come into higher education and become traditional entrants over time, right? So we need to normalize participation in higher education from all walks of life. whether 49 universities are engineered or ready to deliver the same sets of supports to non-traditional entrants as they have to the traditional cadres of entrants right now is a great question. And whether a policy lever which says thou shalt engage with non-traditional entrants drives the behaviour of institutions who may not be geared to enable student success right now is an interesting thing for us to look at. And so before everyone rushes headlong to chase the policy ball, you can look at a system which could be differentiated around the delivery of educational supports, where the market and supports available to students will determine the choices that those students make, rather than perhaps an institution trying to shoehorn themselves into a mould which is just prescribed. So I think the question is excellent, and universities need to be very sure that they can enable student success before they rush to take in students who are going to need those extra supports to be successful.
Well, I think you've given us a lovely spot and response of a good question there that will feed into many of our panels today. But we might let David take his leave. He needs a Lemsip and a little lie down, I think. Thank you very much for joining us remotely, David, and for giving us such an inspiring start for our conference. Thank you very much, David Law. And that is a segue to the first of our panels. I'll invite Ant Bagshaw back to the stage. He's going to call up his four panellists from four different universities. And who knows, they might pick up on that point that David made about all universities might need to think about some of these things differently. I'm sure that's going to come up. Please welcome Ant, who will introduce his panel to you.
Well, I'm delighted to follow David Lloyd's keynote with a really fabulous panel, and you can see who we've got on the screen behind, so we'll actually go straight into questions. I've got a few themes that I'd like to pick up with our panel, and then please do use Slido to ask questions. Professor Buffett, you come from a university with a great reputation on both teaching and research. In the context of the Accord, there's a sort of truism in these policy debates that the emphasis often falls on students and funding and the education side of the system. We also know that not everything's going to get funded, and David mentioned that as well. There's a point here which is about political salience. So higher education is typically referred to as something that's not particularly politically salient, but within that, students tend to be more salient, and politicians will be looking for funding on the student side of the Accord more so than on research. In that context, what are you looking for from the research side to make sure that the full breadth of the Accord is lived out?
Thanks, Ant. Look, I think it's misleading if you just look at the Accord and view there's one chapter on research and that's the job of research, and you can either be excited or disappointed how you read it. I think there are some fundamentals that came through. First of all, the implication is that a university does research and teaching. And as I've mentioned, I think last year at this very forum, you know, universities, not buildings, and it's people, and the academy is the asset here. It's the that's how all the outcomes are obtained. And the academy does research and teaching, and the Accords manage to hold that together. So if you do actually get growth, not everybody's going to be doing the same mix of teaching and research, but if you're getting growth, then you're increasing capacity to do research. So it's kind of reassuring that it's implicit in there. In the funding models, in the way in which the sector is spoken about, it's a university sector, it's not a teaching sector. So that's the first point. The second point, which is I think David alluded to, is the issue that in one way or another, Australia is reliant on the university sector for its capacity in research. Right? We underinvest in research against all the international benchmarks, and the university sector carries the heavy lifting. I was on a panel, as Kent reminded me, last week with Minister Husic, and I made the point that in New South Wales and ACT, which is about 40% of the sector, whichever way you cut it, there's about $4.5 billion worth of investment in research. That's like 2.5 CSIROs and 1.5 times the R&D tax incentive. Of that, $2 billion comes from international education. So if you want to reduce further Australia's contribution to research, then you break the connection that universities have and the sector has as a global player. And the third point is there are some good ideas in the Accord around things that are obviously broken at the moment, the cost of supporting competitive research and all those sorts of things. There are some good ideas there, but they should be taken in the context of the overall investment. And the last point I would make, which I think is really, really important, particularly with the implication that the sector will grow over the next couple of decades, is where is the staff going to come from if we don't start building a PhD capacity? And Australia is doing woeful at the moment in terms of the number of PhD students, Australian students. We're relying in many cases, again, on international. And, you know, all that's helpfully not helpful at the moment, but we'll see where that goes to. Somehow we have to innovate, and it's not just about paying better stipends. Maybe we need to think differently about HDR and really think about career path. Not everybody who has a PhD will want to go into academia. Some will. How do we build that in from the start and think differently so that people don't have to endure another 4 years of poverty, as David pointed out, after the time they spend as an undergraduate?
I think it's a really interesting point about the future academic workforce. One of the bits that I saw in that section on particularly on research is that there's a great focus on HDRs, and that's a recommendation that's been in previous reports. There's actually, I think, less of a point about, well, actually we're in an interconnected global system, and how do we make the whole Australia a place where people come to do their best work, and that we might export some people, but there might be free exchange. It's not just a solution that we need to make on our own.
I think that's absolutely right. If you look at most of universities' academic workforces, they're globally. They come from around the world. They're connected globally. We can't avoid the fact. And it is the case that we will have geopolitical shocks that will shift that, whether they're in critical technologies. We'll kick some own goals along the way. 20 years is a long time to get everything right. But fundamentally, we need to think about where I go back before I started. What we're talking about here is certainly growing the skills and the number of students, but we're also talking about growing the base of the academy, which can be able to deliver those outcomes and do the research. Global is part of it, better empowering pathways to the academy. I think that the key point around the Accord, which David did make, is that the package joins up, but how it's all implemented is going to be the art of getting this right.
Thank you. If I can move to Professor Bartlett, I think this point about complexity and the interplay, but there's a question within the Accord report, and Andrew's spoken to that. There's also a question of the interplay with other parts of the system. If we just take one area here, let's think about the needs of regional Australia, and that's, you know, might be expressed in closing the gap. It might be also, it's also about infrastructure, it's about education systems, health, all of those, the intersection of higher education, tertiary education with the rest of society. What are your reflections on the extent to which the Accord is doing enough, or even reflective enough of the complexity beyond the sector?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think perhaps one of the gaps in the Accord report, although I have to start by saying I think it's an amazing narrative for any university that is working day to day with students in equity, from equity groups. It's so fantastic to see the narrative that's been woven together in the Accord report and recommendations. So having said that, I don't think it's gone far enough in understanding the impact of community change on the delivery of higher education. So I've worked in a few different sorts of universities. I've worked in, I've led campuses in communities that are dying because of industry changes, and I'm currently working in leading a university in an area of huge growth, population growth, and that impacts enormously on how you structure your operations and the delivery of what you do. So I think more recognition needs to be given to the history of the development of universities, how campuses have been created over the years and how they're changing, and helping to facilitate a remodeling of a lot of campuses that exist all over Australia that are no longer meeting the needs of their current communities because they have dwindling infrastructure, poor infrastructure, an inability to keep up with the digital technology demands that our students are absolutely screaming for at the moment. I mean, our student population wants everything, as I'm sure you all realise. They want asynchronous learning. They want campuses that connect them. They want 24-hour support services. They want to be able to connect with their peers. And so we're in a very different environment where students' expectations, society's expectations, and government expectations, I think, are sort of coming together in a very critical way. So how do we respond to that? And now my current university is really working very hard to be innovative. I mean, we have campuses in very thin markets where we struggle to actually get significant numbers of students, but we have infrastructure that needs to be funded. We have research-led operations that really meet the needs of communities from many different perspectives, including offering some postgraduate online education. And then we have a brand new campus in a suburban, peri-urban area in North Brisbane that is comprehensive and meeting the needs of students who have been for a long, long time underrepresented. So we have diversified and really are pushing ahead to try and respond to all the changing community needs and look at how we tap into the population growth up and down the coast of southeast Queensland. But in terms of gaps, in the review, we don't see much light at the end of the tunnel in the short term to helping us support the infrastructure, both physical, digital, cyber. For a small university, actually managing to fund all of those things is incredibly challenging and something that I think smaller universities are going to need assistance with.
Do you think a national regional university would solve those challenges?
Look, the national regional university idea, I think, is worthy of further exploration. I mean, there's discussion about having shared back-of-office services. How that could work across multiple states, I think, is a big question. The examples that have been given are very different to the prospect that's being considered for Australia. And, it assumes that regional universities are all rather similar and would buy into the idea. I actually think some more fundamental questions need to be asked about, the location of a lot of our campuses across Australia, why they're there, what can be done to help support them into the future, and how to diversify their form and function rather than sort of bundle them all up into one entity.
Thank you, Helen. Professor Anderson, one of your interests, one of the things that you and I have often discussed is policy making. And I think one of the really interesting things, and for those of you that follow my very niche interest in policy making in the higher ed sector, is you've got this huge theatre of the accord process, the panel, the submissions, all of that effort put in there. And then you have also the continuation of a whole series of policy agendas that are not within that process, but are adjacent. And we saw that, for example, last year in the student support regulations, and even something like the ombudsman that's coming out. One of the areas that's very live here, and it's been mentioned already, is international student policy, and in a sense, practice more so than explicit policy settings. Can you share with us your view on the relationship between the Accord and, in a sense, what's going on? So that sort of mix between the overall strategy, but actually some very different tactics.
Thanks, Ab. What an interesting question from one of the most intelligent and insightful commentators on the sector.
Is that just a way of delaying the answer?
No,
I'll take the compliment, Ken.
It's not, because I think you've wound through three or four different strains, and really, I'm going to talk about the international one because I think that's the pokey bit. But there's a lot into your question. But I tell you, we're going to come up here in a coffee break in a second, and the person I want to talk to is Helen. Holy shit. She's the smartest one in the room, I reckon. What a fantastic answer. And the way thinking about equity of students being at the heart of this, but how we deliver on that. But she did a really subtle thing there. She then was talking about equity of institutions, which no one's talking about. And then she pulled that in to talk about how difficult it is, and she's been at a number of different institutions, to do some of those big projects when you're a new university. I know who I'm talking with at the coffee break. International students. International students don't feature deeply in this. International students have almost, since really the 1990s mid-1990s when it emerges, it almost has been this kind of thing on the side. It hasn't been central to higher education policy setting. And there's reasons for that, and I'm happy to talk, and there's at least two histories of international education that make it fuller. But the key with international students in particular is student experience. A classroom with a diverse group of students is a better classroom. A laboratory with diverse group of collaborators is a better laboratory. We're going to have a better education system for all students, domestic and international, if we've got international students there. We're going to have a better research outcome if we're linked internationally. So one of the great problems the keynote addressed this a little bit, is because we've always driven this, oh, it's all about money narrative around international students, we've lost the community around us. So I would love to go back to student experience being the core, though I do take Andrew's point, which is, you know, we're research institutes. So from an Accord perspective, it kind of sets it on the side. And instead, we really have the migration review, which is dictating what's going on for the term of this government, and I would say the term of the next government. And that's a post-COVID response. I would hope from an Accord perspective, you put at the heart, we want more students and we want a better student experience. Well, in that answers the international question. You can have more international students, and you can have a focus on student experience if you keep your eye on the ball. Thanks.
I don't know if you follow Alex Usher, but those of you that get his daily email, he's a Canadian commentator, very experienced, does a lot of global stuff. His email today was reflecting on the University's Accord, and he's done an interview with Andrew Norton for his podcast. Bluntly, he describes it as boring. Do you think the Accord report is boring, in as much as it is an uninspiring assessment of the sector?
I'm looking somewhere in the room is University of Newcastle government relations person, and she has counseled me to watch my comments. I'm going to make two quick points, and I'm going to try to make them quick. On the one hand, I freaking love the Accord. Why wouldn't you? More students, more focus on equity, more research, more funding, more bureaucracy. This is like a freaking, this is like, you know, when I was six and I gave a list to my mom and dad for what I wanted
That's four out of five, right?
You know, it was this. So I honestly love it, and I think it's thoughtful, and I think it's been done. But Martin has written about this, and he made the comment when he was up here a moment ago. It is a little bit unrealistic. In the sense of, well, it took I always say a year and a half, but 18 months. So you don't have to do any policy reform for a year and a half. Then you get it and you say, well, we're not going to tell anyone what it says for another 3 months. Then you say, oh, well, we can't really do anything until we get this new committee together to look at what we might do. Oh, and then we really can't do anything because it's talking about 2050, and so we need 3 or 4 governments. And if any of those governments step away from it, then we really... So it's what I call the pragmatic politics of priority. And then I'm going to make a point others have made. Attila Brunj, most recently. If you're a minister of education, you've got 3 big things. You've got early childhood, you've got schools, and you've got higher education and research. If you're in a cost of living crisis, early childhood is really attractive because that hits people's back pockets. If you're thinking about aspiration, and the aspiration, which is really about getting more votes and stuff like that, schools is really important because everyone wants their kid to have a good job, a good life. So in this upcoming series of budgets, saying we want more research is a hard sell. Saying we want more students is a pretty hard sell, particularly when they're not rocking up. So I do think if I were the minister, I think he's done a great job. I think he's built a lot of capital in the way that he's done this with our sector and with his colleagues. And so I think he will be able to cash, I would say, about $100 million in this budget for us. Question is where you spend that, and I would spend it on equity.
Thanks, Ken. Professor van der Lely, one of the things I'm also interested in is not that this is just an indulgence, but maybe it is an indulgence, is the intersection between the policy design and the actual practice within institutions. And what we see in the Accord report is a number of areas where I would argue it's an intrusion, but it's a policy setting that says we're going to mandate different ways of behaving. And one of our audience members also picked up on this. There's the recommendation 31 calls for professional learning and teaching standards for academics, minimum teaching qualifications. I think it also speaks to the question from the earlier session about staff upskilling to make sure that that everyone is able to serve an increasingly diverse student base. What's your reaction to this really quite assertive challenge to the sector to say you haven't been doing it well enough, and by the way, we're going to mandate how you respond?
Maybe a little controversial. I welcome it wholeheartedly. I think if we are going to deliver on the ambitions that are set out in the Accord to truly have an inclusive sector that meets the skills needs for generations to come, we have to fundamentally change what and how we teach, and we have to make sure we have a workforce that is confident and capable to be able to do that. So embedding transition pedagogies, thinking differently about how you unbundle a curriculum. You can't unbundle a curriculum that is poorly designed. So it's...
Well, you can, but you shouldn't.
You can, definitely. So good quality curriculum design that allows you the flexibility to be able to meet students where they're at, and I think that is increasingly important. Students are expecting us to teach them in different ways, to be able to engage in different ways, as Helen mentioned earlier. But that requires an academic workforce that knows how to do that. So the really great question before about how you support student success in the classroom, and it is in the classroom, but it's also outside the classroom, and there's some work for us to do across our operating models to think really carefully about how academic staff work with professional staff. And I think the support for students policy, and I could go off on a tangent there, which I won't, about the reasons why the implementation of that has been somewhat challenging. But it does pose a challenge to the sector to be accountable to students and to do better. And that takes good training. It takes thoughtful training and time. And it means that we need to, across the sector, break down the barriers to competition between one institution and another, because there are not enough resources for us all to embark on complex and detailed professional learning pathways. The Higher Education Academy in the past, Advanced HE, has helped somewhat in getting us to think about what a profession for teachers really looks like. But not every academic is engaging in that. Not every academic is truly an expert at learning and teaching. And again, I'll throw a challenge out there. Not every academic is spending as much time in scholarly practice as they are in being up to date with the latest literature. And I think we see that a lot now in the technology space and how willing and capable academic staff are to embrace the affordances of AI, rather than seeing it potentially as a academic integrity threat, but rather thinking about AI augmentation and how could that free up workload effort for an academic staff member so that they truly can work with students and focus on the creation of good quality curriculum.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. It's another one that's been picked up in the questions is actually that use of AI tools as a way of... I think the exciting bit for me is you have the potential of both better quality outcomes and also potentially more efficiency of delivery. That feels like a hugely exciting moment in a way that previously innovation might have come at a much more significant cost. Can I... Andrew, please.
You go and I'll ask.
One of the things, though, you talked about the system as you see it and the support that's required. One of the things that I see is that if you think about every individual, so if you think about the unit by which higher education is delivered as a person, the incentives are pretty strong in terms of the emphasis on research. That is the thing that you can take with you, the thing with your name on it. We actually don't have, you might have teaching scores within your institution, but they're not necessarily comparable, they're not portable. What do you think might need, or rather do you think there needs to be change in that fundamental incentive structure if we're going to unlock the better learning and teaching experience?
And I think I've been talking about this for 20 years. We need to really value teachers and teachers at all level of society. So this just isn't higher education, but we need to value our school teachers and our early childhood teachers as well. But in higher education, we have gone through a series of changes, the disestablishment of the Office of Learning and Teaching, for example, sent shockwaves through and sent us back in terms of really thinking about how we recognise and support good quality teaching, how we enable cross-institutional collaboration to really drive that. So the loss of the fellowships program in particular, I think, really set us back in being able to get a collaborative approach to the kind of work that really drives transformational change, and it's worth going back and looking at the work of those fellowships. So we need to value teachers, and it's great to see more universities putting on the sort of teaching focused academic roles, supporting grants in learning and teaching, and thinking through what the national awards for university teaching looks like. But I think the piece in the accord, which I welcome so much, is that there really is an emphasis on how do we support and recognise good quality teaching and enable a workforce that will deliver that.
Thank you. Please, Andrew.
Yeah, I was just going to comment on the question I think both Kent raised and others about the response to the accord. Is it a response that is a highly regulated and managed and designed process, or is there some other way of doing it? And this is a sort of an old bloke story, right? I've been around a while, and I can remember the pre-demand-driven system, and universities would sit around and we would negotiate our profile, and that profile had a whole range of different dimensions to it in terms of which students and how many and which disciplines and things like that. And you know, then there was the fundamental change for the demand-driven system. And I think most people embrace growth, more graduates, There were equity targets there. They would sort of drop part of the way through, but there were equity targets there. And the sector responded. It grew quickly. It grew actually ahead of the demand-driven system being started, if you look at the way the data moves, because people were allowed to over-enrol. But the sector responded, and it was able to take up the capacity and got the benefits out of that. And then, of course, the cost started getting high. I'm not going to where it was capped, but the parallel response in there was to say, well, if we have to support all the things that we're expected to do, and we were encouraged to do this, let's see whether we can engage in the global education space. And another success story, institutions responded, positioned themselves, whether it's transnational education, there's an online story in here as well. So I think the sector has shown a capacity to respond. And you tend to get to where, what the boundary conditions. We talk about a lack of diversity. Well, if you've got all that got the same funding model and you're all sitting under the demand-driven system and you're all going for the same thing, surprise, surprise, you've got the same mix underneath. So there may be things to do differently, but I'm a fan of actually setting the boundary conditions and allowing the sector to respond. And if it doesn't respond, well, then you apply the measures that you need to get the response. So I think the accord is positioned in that context, has to be positioned in that context. Let's not say everything is broken, because there's a massive capacity there in both teaching and research, in both facing the equity issue, in both facing the pathways and transitions. Newcastle does it extraordinarily well with enabling programs. We've got the machinery. The question is how you purpose it to get the outcomes that are desirable in a way that doesn't just sort of weight the system down again.
And I think that picks up on David's point about the really the importance of the commission, that actually the design of the commission and whether it is providing those parameters. I completely agree with you on that, that setting system aspirations and nudges rather than mandating or prescribing the way institutions should behave. Kent, did you want to come back on that?
Look, I do have one or two thoughts, but again, the smartest person is sitting next to me. Helen, do you want to jump in first?
Look, no, go on.
So two thoughts. I agree with Andrew's presumption that universities have been an incredible success story in playing whatever the game is really well, in a really smart way, in a way that it surpasses other countries. And we should commend ourselves on that. What I do worry when you think about the sector, so not the students, but the sector, the 39, 42, whatever, however you want to count the numbers, is we have equality, not equity. And this goes, David spoke a little bit about this, but if you remember that visual graphic we've all seen in the training, equality being everyone on the same step. There are some people who are in a better advantage to see over the fence if the step is the same. So the institutions are a bit like that as well, which is why I keep deferring to Helen, because I think she has a really good story to tell in that space. And I think we're terrified of that. But I also resist something that David said, which is the policy says how you earn money is standard, but how you spend money actually is decided at an institutional level. And just because all the institutions spend it in the same way, that's not the government telling them. That's a decision that vice chancellors, deputy vice chancellors, chancellors, councillors are making.
Look, there are a couple of things that I just want to put into the mix here that we haven't talked about yet. And that, again, I don't think the report, the accord really sort of extends the thinking on as much as we would like. And one of them is the interface with different sectors. So there is, of course, a focus in the accord on the importance of higher education and VET working much more closely together and achieving greater integration in terms of, you know, pathways for students, joint delivery, and so on. But until we can address the regulatory frameworks and the funding models, you know, we're very limited in terms of what we can actually achieve within the current environment. And I think that, you know, there is going to need to be greater ambition and appetite for looking at that interface and determining how we can make it work better. I mean, I've got two campuses where we're co-located with TAFE and one with Trades Training as well. And we do, you know, a reasonable amount of good work with them, but it's very limited as to how far we can go without some of those broader policy settings being adjusted. The second area I think I wanted just to reference is the interface with schools, and this is particularly important in the regions. You know, the trust that's built between schools and regional campuses is really critical to developing something that works in those localities. And one of the things that perhaps, while we know that schools is part of the bigger policy agenda, I think that recognising that local initiatives and local actions can actually achieve an awful lot for students from equity groups. And just to finish on that, the intervention around early offers is slightly concerning for many regional universities where they've worked for many years to achieve an equity pathway that's working, and to disassemble that, I think, is potentially a great threat to the opportunities of those equity students in many regional areas.
Thanks, Helen. Can I actually pick up on another point that's been raised by an audience question? We're anticipating two structural changes which will incentivize institutions to recruit students from more diverse backgrounds. That is specifically First Nations students and sort of equity targets, which is a sort of, there's a series of dimensions. And the other is what we're anticipating is additional financial loading for students who would otherwise experience disadvantage, and it's expected as a corrective measure there. Those two, as far as I can see, make the competitive dynamic for the recruitment of students with identified characteristics more intense, and obviously has consequences, as you were saying, in terms of the where students might otherwise have gone, and there'll be a wider range of institutions will be chasing those students. How do you think about the intersection of the competitive dynamic with the need to support students, offering them the best that we can?
Look, there is increased competition, there's no doubt about it, and I think the focus on regional students is certainly raising the interest of the metro universities in addressing the needs of those students. The question, of course, which has been raised before, is whether they have the right sort of infrastructure, culture and so on to enable those students to be successful. So I think that there could be unintended consequences of this broad focus on elevating participation from equity groups, and I think that perhaps hasn't been looked at as much as it could be.
I think the work in the references in the accord and the support for the regional university centres is critical in there. I think there will be an unintended consequence where potentially students who would have gone to a regional university will move. Some will move.
Which may not be a bad thing.
Though there's a question about how prepared are universities to support the cohort of the student? How well is the universal design embedded in there, and what does the support framework look like? I think the regional university centres and the partnership with universities will help us move forward in a really clear way that supports students to be able to stay where their families are, where they have a job. And that comes down to how do we embed flexibility in our delivery models that allow students to be able to engage in education from where they're at. What that means is that the students who are partnering with those regional university centres will need to do more heavy lifting, again, because the equity students who would have already come will potentially move around in the system, and we others will bear the responsibility of raising aspiration and supporting students to be able to...
I think it's a very reasonable way of thinking about it, to say that those students who have not previously revealed themselves as being, as going into taking places in higher education, they're going to be harder to reach and they're going to be harder and more expensive to support through. Andrew?
So three points around it. One is, drawing on the point I was trying to make before, was if you just simply have something like the demand-driven system, you don't get the outcome that you want. And that's where competition is most rife. So, and I've heard Barney Glover refer to the proposal of the Accord as a sort of managed growth proposal. So if you combine some form of compact with universities and around their mission and their approach with a managed number of places that you get, then some of the competition will go. You're always going to get the case that some of the wealthy universities can simply buy students out of regions or anywhere else. I don't think we'll avoid some of that. But there is another piece that has been alluded to, and it's in the report. That's the sort of pathways piece. Relationship, as Helen pointed out, is really important, not only with the being able to make early offers, but the relationship with schools and relationship with students. And if the growth is managed in conjunction with the increase in the funding of pathways, then I think you can probably get the less egregious end. It won't stop competitive behaviour. As I said, it won't stop some own goals and things, but it will allow us to sort of stage and address what wasn't able to be addressed under the settings that we had previously.
Can I do a bit of rapid fire? How can we make the case for greater investment in the sector?
I think the Universities Australia campaign right now, which is talking to the broader public about what universities, is the first step, and that will move us up a few single percentage points. But if you really want to move the dial to 55% participation, we need to better understand why that 15% isn't coming right now. And I, despite what everyone has said, I don't think we've done that research.
Look, I think the university case in isolation of the need for economic transformation in Australia isn't made, right? If we don't have fundamental change, growth in the economy, competitiveness, all this aspiration for skills is to no purpose. So they have to travel together. So the case for universities is made by the type of economy that we want to have in the future. And I suspect that that's at least one of the disjuncts at the moment. We're not quite sure. We're not sure whether we want more complexity in the economy or less complexity in the economy and double down on our traditional areas. We got scared of innovation. Remember the word innovation a few elections ago, and it terrified everybody. The cab drivers thought they were losing their jobs and things. That whole issue and the productivity piece. I just think there's a selling conversation that hasn't made. We're not the only ones to make it. If we don't have the economic settings right, then none of the social issues are going to work because there are no jobs and the universities won't grow. So I think they have to travel together.
Just quickly, I think there can't be anything more compelling than the facts and figures at the moment, and we just need to communicate those a lot better. From a regional perspective, 7 out of 10 students will stay and work in the regions, contributing to their communities and the economic, cultural and social prosperity of those regions. And that certainly isn't the case in students graduating from metro universities. Only around 2 out of 10 of those students will actually go and work in a regional setting. So, you know, really telling that story and looking at the facts and figures around the economic contributions to made, particularly in the regions.
Just because I've made two sycophantic comments with regards to Helen, I get one pushback. I don't think we have a problem selling the story. That's what I'm talking about. That's going to get 1 or 2%. That's not going to deliver 15%. We've been telling the effing story for a long time.
Well, is that a government relations approved comment?
We need to get in the heads of the 15% that are saying, university's not for me, full stop. We don't need to say how wonderful it is.
No, that's fair. Final question before Martin wraps us up. One of the things about the Accord and its 408 pages, in some ways, because it's so comprehensive, it is trying to address so many parts of the sector. And I'll echo comments earlier. I actually think it's fantastic. I think there's elements of it that are really, really brilliant. There are some the aspiration for greater participation, use of research. There's some really, really important and valuable parts to it. Happy to pick apart minor bits of it. Do you think, though, that the existence of the report might constrain the potential for innovation that we might otherwise have seen in the sector we might otherwise need? And that's an abuse of Michael's question, but I've got there.
Yes.
No. Look, it's inevitable you have to have the detail to be able to make the decisions. I think there's a very clear narrative. I think many of us have heard Mary, for example, run the narrative. Is that you can either work back from the 55%, or you can realise what you want as an outcome and work forward to what the solution is. And I think the guideposts are pretty clear. The challenge, as we all know and as we talked about earlier, is it's expensive. It's expensive to remedy some of the things we've got wrong in the past. It's expensive to do in the future, and the investment won't be only be in universities, it'll be in the entire sector, as somebody pointed out elsewhere. So the challenge, I think it's fairly clear. The reality is, how is the funding going to work? Where is the funding coming from? Can the case be made that the benefits are worth the investment?
I'm in the no camp as well and agree with all of that. And I might just add that, you know, if universities are sitting back and waiting, then, you know, they're going to get what's coming to them, because the times are changing, so much is happening. I think that in actual fact, the Accord should be spurring universities on to innovate. I think it's incredibly stimulating. I think it's really caught everybody's attention, and I think universities are recognising that they do have to change, and they can do a lot. Beside the Accord, I think there's so many great innovations already happening. Yes, we need money to support, you know, some of the bigger ideas, but I think there's an awful lot of scope to innovate. And if you just look at the private sector, look at Torrens University, the fastest growing university in Australia, I think we're second, it can be done. And, you know, if a private university is showing how it can be done at lower cost, then that's a big message for us all.
And I'm not sure whether I was a yes or a no. I think, yes, it will stifle innovation if we wait. So we cannot wait even for the government to come out and say, here's how, and here's what the Tertiary Education Commission is going to look like, and here are all the rules that we want to impose. We need to be on the front foot, innovating, driving some of the change to the narrative, but also contributing really positively to what the government wants to achieve, and help them also work through how they're going to get there. So I think there's a lot we can do.
There's a fabulous point in which to end, and I think it echoes something that David Lloyd said earlier, which is getting on with the job at hand. And I think, we've had a lot of time to discuss all the issues. We've got the report, but each of us, and look, it's been fabulous to hear from each of you about the work that you're doing and also the opportunities that you see in the sector. So can I invite everyone to thank all the members of the panel?
So there we are. That was a fantastic panel, a fantastic keynote from the chair of UA, and a very in-depth, reflective and a considered review of the Australian Universities Accord final report, giving lots of pointers and a great summary to what the sector thinks of the journey that still remains ahead, with the overriding message of we can wait to engage, we can wait to hear for final reflections on what the future holds, but the imperative for all of us is just to get on with it, to address the change by being the change that we want to see in the world, and to bringing about an improvement in higher education for all by our own actions without waiting for policy direction. Thanks for joining us on the first session of this day. That's all we've got time for this week on HEDX.